do is read some passages from the Dharma, which is presumably the Buddha talking here, or as close as one can get to the original teachings of the Buddha, the original view, even the original words. And I want to talk first about and have us confront his very firm teachings about the, as he calls it, the gratification, the danger, and the escape from sensual pleasure. Whether it's the sensual pleasure of seeing a flower grow in the, you know, in your garden, to you know, getting blasted at a tailgate party after your football team wins, to wall socket sex, to getting really jazzed that, you know, your favorite, you know, political candidate won an election for president. I mean, the whole run, okay? So I want to confront that with you. And I want to confront it in the frame that the Buddha lays out, which is a frame of a great interest in complete enlightenment. And then I want to read some passages where he seems to be talking about a kind of pleasure, a kind of emotionally positive or positively valenced experience, which is perfectly all right and in fact is useful. And then I want to open it up to a consideration of how one can engage possibly a household life with its pleasures, particularly focusing here on physical pleasures, in such a way that potentially one does not become caught by them, based on some understanding now, which the Buddha did not have, of how biology and the brain work, to both kind of attach to pleasure and also to be fulfilled by pleasure and move beyond pleasure. And how might the brain do that? And then let's really talk about it. So that's what I hope to do. Okay? So, first, the bad news. Okay? So, let's see here. In this particular sutta, and I'll read it kind of briskly, and I think it's particularly fun if you haven't very often done this, to just kind of confront and hear the traditional language. In a good translation, you know, this, I really, as you know, I really have a lot of regard for this particular anthology and this particular translator. In a good translation, I think it's very clear what's being said. Whether you agree with it, it's up to you to really consider. And as Lydon said to me just before we started here, this is what's taught in one tradition. So my frame here is not laying this on you like you ought to think this way. It's let's confront this view, which is within a frame of what helps attain enlightenment. That's the only thing he's interested in. He's not interested in quality of life per se. He's only interested in enlightenment. So let's try to work within that frame, and then you can ask yourself later how interested you really are in enlightenment. You know? Okay? All right, here we go. So he's addressing Magandhya, and Magandhya supposedly is a hedonist. So he's sort of like a modern Westerner who is trying to say basically, who is making an argument for hedonistic pleasure. Okay? So he says to Magandhya, "So Magandhya, formerly when I lived the household life, I enjoyed myself, provided and endowed with the five chords of sensual pleasure, with forms cognizable by the eye, with sounds cognizable by the ear, odors cognizable by the nose, flavors cognizable by the tongue, tactile objects cognizable by the body that are wished for, desired, agreeable, and likable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust." All right? And so he's tracking the five senses. "I had three palaces, one for the rainy season, one for the winter, and one for the summer. I lived in the rain's palace for the 4 months of the rainy season, enjoying myself with musicians, none male, and I did not go down to the lower palace." And the very interesting footnote, which is worth reading, hang on. So one of the commentators says that nun male means that everyone was women. Not only the musicians, but all posts in the palace, including the doorkeepers, were filled by women. This is an early commentator who was saying that, you know, it had been handed down within a few centuries that this is the way it was in young Siddhartha's life. His father had provided him with three palaces and the entourage of women in hopes of keeping him confined to the lay life and distracting him from thoughts of renunciation. And Magandhya, by the way, was a philosophical hedonist who held that one should allow the five senses to enjoy their respective objects. He criticized the Buddha for advocating restraint and control of the senses. The Buddha is about to demonstrate the defects in sensual enjoyment. That's the footnote. So that's the frame here for the commentary to Magandhya. Then the Buddha continues. On a later occasion, having understood as they really are the origin, the passing away, the gratification, the danger, and the escape, in the case of sensual pleasures, I abandoned craving for sensual pleasures. I removed the fever of sensual pleasures, and I dwell without thirst with a mind inwardly at peace. Thirst is craving. Tanha is thirst. So he says, I now live without any craving at all, with a mind completely at peace. I see other people who are not free from lust for sensual pleasures being devoured by craving for sensual pleasures, burning with the fever of sensual pleasures, indulging in sensual pleasures, and I do not envy them, nor do I delight therein. Why is that? Because there is, Magandhya, a delight apart from sensual pleasures, apart from unwholesome states, which surpasses even divine bliss. And the footnote says, he's referring to enlightenment based on the fourth jhana. The fourth jhana being the fourth of the four jhanas named in right concentration, which is part of the one of the eight elements of the Noble Eightfold Path. Since I take delight in that, I do not envy what is inferior, nor do I delight within. Suppose Magandhya, a householder, was rich, affluent, and wealthy, and being provided and endowed with the five cords of sensual pleasure, he might enjoy various things. I'm going to kind of paraphrase a bit here. Let's see. Having conducted himself well in body, speech, and mind, on the breakup of the body after death, he might be reborn in a good destination, in a heavenly world in the retinue of these various devas. And there, surrounded by a group of nymphs in the Nandana grove, some heavenly Olympian realm, he would enjoy himself, provided and endowed with the five cords of divine sensual pleasure. Suppose he saw a householder enjoying himself. What do you think, Magandhya? Would the young deva, surrounded by the group of nymphs in the Nandanda grove, enjoying himself, envy the householder? Or would he be enticed by human sensual pleasures? No, Magandhya replies, no, Master Gautama. Why not? Because divine sensual pleasures are more excellent and sublime than human sensual pleasures. So too, Magandhya, formerly when I lived the household life, I enjoyed myself. On a later occasion, having understood what as they are, I abandoned craving, etc., etc., and I dwell without thirst with a mind inwardly at peace. I see other people who are not free from lust for sensual pleasures being devoured by craving, and I do not envy them, nor do I delight therein. Why? Because there is a delight apart from sensual pleasures, apart from unwholesome states, which surpasses even divine bliss. Since I take delight in that, I do not envy what is inferior. Okay? Then he uses another very pointed simile. He says, suppose, Magandhya, there was a leper with sores and blisters on his limbs, being devoured by worms, scratching the scabs off the openings of his wounds with his nails, cauterizing his body over a burning charcoal pit. Then his friends and companions, his kinsmen and relatives, would bring a physician to treat him. The physician would make medicine for him, and by means of that medicine, the man would be cured of his leprosy and would become well and happy, independent, master of himself, able to go where he likes. Then he might see another leper with sores and blisters on his limbs, being devoured by worms, scratching the scabs off the openings of his wounds with his nails, cauterizing his body over a burning charcoal pit. What do you think, Magandhya? Would that man envy the leper for his burning charcoal pit, or his use of medicine. No, Master Gautama. Why is that? Because when there is sickness, there is need for medicine. And when there is no sickness, there is no need for medicine. So too, Magandhya, you know, formerly when I lived a household life, I liked sensual pleasures, but now that I'm enlightened, I have a higher delight. Suppose, Magandhya, there was a leper, blah de blah de blah, takes medicine, he gets happened cured. Then two strong men would seize him by both arms and drag him toward a burning charcoal pit. So now the leper is cured, but he's being dragged to the pit. What do you think, Magandhya? Would that man twist his body this way and that? Yes, Master Gautama. Why is that? Because that fire is indeed painful to touch, hot and scorching. This is a really important point coming up. What do you think, Magandhya? Is it only now that the fire is painful to touch, hot and scorching? Or previously too, was that fire painful to touch, hot and scorching? Master Gautama, that fire is now painful to touch, hot and scorching, and previously too that fire was painful to touch, hot and scorching. For when that man was a leper, etc., etc., his faculties were impaired. Thus, though the fire was actually painful to touch, he acquired a mistaken perception of it as pleasant. So too, Magandhya, in the past, sensual pleasures were painful to touch, hot and scorching. In the future, sensual pleasures will be painful to touch, hot and scorching. And now, at present, sensual pleasures are painful to touch, hot and scorching. But these people who are not free from lust for sensual pleasures, who are devoured by craving for sensual pleasures, who burn with the fever of sensual pleasures, have faculties that are impaired. Thus, though sensual pleasures are actually painful to touch, they acquire a mistaken perception of them as pleasant. Suppose, Magandhya, there was a leper with sores and blisters, etc., etc. The more he scratches the scabs and cauterizes his body, the fouler, more evil smelling, and the more infected the openings of his wounds would become. Yet he would find a certain measure of satisfaction and enjoyment in scratching the openings of his wounds. So too, Magandhya, people who are not free from lust for sensual pleasures, who are devoured by craving for sensual pleasures, who burn with the fever of sensual pleasures, still indulge in sensual pleasures. The more they indulge in sensual pleasures, the more their craving for sensual pleasures increases, and the more they are burned by the fever of sensual pleasures. Yet they find a certain measure of satisfaction and enjoyment, independence on the five chords of sensual pleasure. Let me read that critical last little sentence here. The more they indulge in sensual pleasures, the more their craving for sensual pleasures increases, and the more they are burned by the fever of sensual pleasures. Yet they find a certain measure of satisfaction and enjoyment, independence on the five chords of sensual pleasure. His view is pretty clear, isn't it? I don't think there's a lot of shilly-shallying around there, right? So now, let's consider a different take. This is the Buddha's account of his own awakening. Here we go. I'm going to kind of bounce around a little bit. So he's talking basically where he describes his own ascetic journey, where he turned utterly, it isn't that he renounced sensual pleasure, it's that he turned against it. Critical point. So he's describing in a series of passages, which we've covered in here earlier in the year, his own ascetic practices. I mean, at the end of which he says he was so skinny, for example, because of eating so little, my ribs jutted out as gaunt as the crazy rafters of an old roofless barn. Because of eating so little, the gleam of my eyes sank far down in their sockets, looking like the gleam of water that has shrunk far down in a deep well. Because of eating so little, my belly skin adhered to my backbone. Thus, if I touched my belly skin, I encountered my backbone. Because of eating so little, if I defecated or urinated, I fell over on my face there. Because of eating so little, if I tried to ease my body by rubbing my limbs with my hands, the hair rotted at its roots fell from my body as I rubbed. And I thought, whatever ascetics or Brahmins in the past, you know, have experienced painful feelings due to exertion, this is the utmost. There is none beyond that. In other words, I've done as much asceticism as you could possibly do. But by this racking practice of austerities, I have not attained any superhuman distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones. Could there be another path to enlightenment? This is a critical fork in the Buddha's own journey, right here. He says, so, and he's describing his own considerations, his own, like where he was in his own process. So I've hit bottom. I've done what people told me to do. I've gone completely against pleasure. I've had incredible austerity. I'm about to die. I've taken the path of austerity all the way. Am I enlightened? No. Then I considered, I recall that when my father, the Sakyan, that's his clan, was occupied, while I was sitting in the cool shade of a rose apple tree, apparently when he was a boy, when Gautama was a boy, secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, I entered and dwelled in the first jhana, this deep state of blissful absorption, which is accompanied by thought and examination, with rapture and happiness born of seclusion. Could this be the path to enlightenment? I wondered to myself. Then following on that memory came the realization. This is indeed the path to enlightenment. I thought, why am I afraid of that happiness that has nothing to do with sensual pleasures and unwholesome states? I thought, I am not afraid of that happiness that has nothing to do with sensual pleasures and unwholesome states. So then he goes on, and there's a critical phrase that Jim in the back there pointed out to me or reminded me of last time that I really want to name here, which I think is really crucial, which is he's describing, the Buddha's describing going through the jhanas, and there's this recurring phrase, such pleasant feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. And he repeats that again and again and again. The pleasant feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. Then he describes his three main realizations over the course of the night where he had his own awakening, these three famous realizations. And after each one, he repeats this, this line. He says, ignorance was banished and true knowledge arose. Darkness was banished and light arose, as happens in one who dwells diligent, ardent, and resolute. But such pleasant feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. And the second watch of the night, the second major awakening, again, such pleasant feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. By the way, previously he talked about painful austerities and painful feelings, difficult feelings, and he said about them as well. Whatever arose in my mind, whatever painful feeling arose in my mind, did not invade my mind and remain. And then there's the final paragraph, final realization. But nonetheless, such pleasant feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. And to kind of wrap up here, as a footnote, it says, the point is that when pleasure arises from seclusion and detachment, it is no longer something to be feared and banished by the practice of austerities, but becomes an adjunct of the higher stages along the path to enlightenment. Okay, so you see the tension here? On the one hand, we have the challenge, right? She names very clearly the challenge of the The more they indulge in sensual pleasures, the more their craving for sensual pleasures increases, and the more they are burned by the fever of sensual pleasures. Okay, on the one hand. On the other hand, sometimes such pleasant feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and return. Right? Why am I afraid of that happiness that has nothing to do with sensual pleasures and unwholesome states? See? Okay. So here's what I propose we do. I propose that, to give everyone a chance to kind of think about this and talk about it, that if you're willing to do this in a moment, not yet, grab a partner, and then just for 5 minutes, talk back and forth about how you can imagine yourself in your own life practicing with sensual pleasure in such a way that it does not invade your mind and remain. And so that you can perhaps engage it without developing craving for it. Yeah?
I just have a question. I thought that last part that you read said that if it didn't have anything to do with sensual pleasure or unwholesome state.
That's what he's saying. Yeah.
So we're adding that in.
Yeah, I am. Hope he doesn't mind. Yeah, thank you for clarifying that. Exactly right. Exactly right. Thank you. Exactly right. I'm raising the question here, which I don't think is alone to me. I mean, it's a question on the table. How do we engage a life where we prefer one kind of latte to another, right? Where we still want to have sex, where we, you know, are choosing clothes that please the eye rather than ones that don't. I mean, all the myriad forms of sensual pleasure in a household or life.
And do we know how old he was when he said that?
Which one? When he's supposedly he left his home when he was at late 20s, 28, 29, and he supposedly practiced for about 7 years. So when he's commenting on his own realization and he's reflecting, on this, when he hit the nadir of his own austerities, he apparently became enlightened fairly quickly after he hit the bottom of his austerities, got a little sustenance, began to practice more deeply, and then just ignited. He was probably around 35. So he was fairly young, middle-aged, young middle-aged. You know, he was full of sap, full of vim and vigor. He was not all dried up. Darn! Okay, so I encourage you to engage it your own way. How do you engage this? Let's, particularly again, if you're saying, presume for the next 5 minutes that your number one priority is enlightenment.
What?
Your number one priority is enlightenment.
Wow.
Okay? If my number one priority is enlightenment, or pretty darn close to it, how do I engage sensual pleasure, broadly defined, in a way that does not breed the conditions of clinging and therefore suffering. Okay? So why don't you grab a partner? And this is not like we're going to figure this out tonight. More than anything, let's engage it. If you want to do it, grab a partner. If you don't have a partner, raise your hand. If you want a partner and don't have one, raise your hand. Okay. So just talk back and forth for 5 minutes. No A's and B's. Just talk.
Thank you.
Start wrapping it up. And come on back. I love this topic.
I know you do.
I love this topic because it's. Yeah. Okay. Come on back. I was just sharing that it may be evident. I love this topic partly because I think it's often when we get pressed hard against a fierce teaching that we really rise somehow. I don't know. For me, the analogy is this conversation I had once with this major mentor when I was at the very end of being a college student in 1975 or so. I said something, like with my long hair and gold wire-rimmed glasses, that I thought creativity was the complete transcendence and breaking free of all restriction. That's what creativity was. See, to me as a young person, certainly. And my mentor, who was a wonderful, wise man named Jules Zentner, said, well, maybe so. It reminds me of like a Zen line, maybe so. He said, I think creativity arises in the confrontation with the most rigid forms, like haiku. 3 lines, 17 syllables, that's it, deal with it. You know, a sonnet, a Gothic cathedral, a sonata, a form. And so I just love this collision with the radical edge of a teaching that's directed unreservedly toward liberation. What do we do then? I love that. Okay, so what'd you come up with? Of course. I said Linda would talk about sex and I would try to talk about renunciation.
So I think it's an error to conflate sensual pleasure with craving. The problem is craving. Whatever the object of the craving is. Oh, good. So we got that clear.
Is there agreement about that? Yeah. All right. A loophole, maybe.
But likewise, aversion is also not so skillful. The sensual pleasures can immediately be a gateway to the mystery. They can immediately be a gateway to the sacred.
Why? Can you say more about that?
I was telling Harold, when I see a drop of water on a leaf and I see the light sun shining on it, I'm just popped into a larger consciousness. It's no effort. It just goes to a larger space, a larger consciousness. So sensuality, our senses, can be the gateway to that kind of awe and joy. So then when you were talking about the jhanas, you just learn to value the peace, the tranquility, the rapture over getting addicted or caught in craving or aversion about anything else. But it's just being open to the sacred and the mystery. And that's the pathway. That was what I came up with.
Thank you. You worded that so well.
Yes.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. See you?
We came up with the same thing, that sexuality and sensuality is okay just as long as there's no craving.
Uh-huh.
But we experienced a problem recently with some exotic flowers and dying in the frost where there was a
I'm craving my bougainvillea, which
got killed. Every day I go out looking for the sound of life and help them cry. Because I wanted to film video for about 20 years. I craved them. And then when I got them, I was clinging to them and had them 3 weeks and whoosh, they oh.
So just wait till the weather warms up.
Well.
Yes.
There's an experience in samadhi of deep bliss that one can get attached to. And that sense of equanimity and just wide openness is also something occasionally one can share with another person and making love where you experience that union with another person. And so that wasn't talked about, nor explored tantra, where you stay on the edge of unbelievable sensation without going over into orgasm. I don't know if you want to comment someone
that well, but what's the point of that? So one could say, I mean, one could go up to the French Laundry or Cyrus and just have unbelievable amounts of physical pleasure, right? What? Don't swallow. Right, exactly. So, but that's to what end, though? So the end there is sensual pleasure, but what if your end is liberation? What's the point of tantra?
Well, I think there's a quality.
Linda answered that question, but I'm asking you the same question. She did answer it already. If you're interested in liberation, what's the point of tantra?
I think it's similar to breath work or to sitting on a cushion for weeks at the end. That it's a process that can lead to liberation. If I don't get attached to it, in the same way I don't get attached to samadhi, sitting by myself.
Yeah. So how do you engage? How do you engage strong pleasure, including emotional pleasure, the pleasure of resonance or closeness, or the pleasure of resolving some threat in your world? You know, how do you stay really present with that, without craving arising, developing in the mind?
I think it's a lot easier to stay on the cushion by myself than sucking my tantra.
How do you have great sex without wanting more? How do you have great food without wanting more? How do you have great closeness without wanting more? How do you see beautiful dewdrops in the sunlight without wanting more? I'm saying it like you can't. I'm asking, okay, how can you?
Great.
How do you have that bliss without wanting more? And are some pleasures more available to that self-destruction of craving in the moment of experiencing the pleasure? Okay. So there's a question. Yeah.
I mean, what occurred to me is one way to keep that kind of craving where it's not, I mean, where it doesn't become craving, is that when you have the experience of, I don't know, whatever you want to call it, being or oneness or whatever word you want to give it, it's so satisfying that nothing else really compares. I mean, it's so, I just think as you spend more time there, other things aren't quite, though they don't have the pull. They don't have the power that they would normally have if you didn't have that experience to prepare
with,
or to ground yourself with.
Right. Okay, how about Jim, then Harold, then you? Okay, Jim. I'll learn your name in a minute. Jim.
Oh, this is too simplistic, but I'm taking off when you said the joy of the light and the leaf and that. You took it and went with it and sounded great, and it is, I'm sure. But that seems to me to be the question, not the answer. And it is this, it seems to me that the Buddha went in with an agenda. His agenda was, I'm not going to claim and I'm not going to reject. And so whatever it is, the pleasures that arose in me, I saw them as pleasures, but I sure as a dickens was guarding against their entering my, invading me and remaining. And so it's pretty simplistic to say you've got to prepare yourself for it. So, and with your agenda, that's what I think he did. Whether that's doable, other than last week I was You know, we've been with you, Rick, through the hard ones, you know, birth, death, age, and now here we come at Christmas and you've got us into a black hole. It's like, how do you face craving and not want more? Well, I have a simple answer. You know, be prepared. It seems to me the Buddha was prepared for it. I'm not yet. I haven't gone through that.
Well, going to a couple, so I just want to call out a few things that people have said, okay? One is to recognize that there are certain pleasures, if you will, that seem even more satisfying than other ones, right? Which the Buddha certainly said. You seem to be speaking to that. You're saying over there, Jim, you know, have a mind that doesn't attach to either the pleasant or the unpleasant, right? But it's clear, on the other hand, the Buddha was not seeking to maximize the pleasant. The Buddha was not sitting in a room thinking, how can I maximize the pleasant without getting caught? Right? Which is what we're doing. He had a very different agenda, and you're saying that's part of what made it work, right?
In a way, in a paradox, not to disagree, and I may not be in the same view, he was as greedy and desirous and could you possibly want anything more than to be enlightened?
There you go. All right. Okay, good. Oh, okay, you had that point too. Okay, let's get more people. So, Harold and you. Harold?
So, staying within the framework that you're posing, which is if your objective is enlightenment, then the question of what do I do in the greatest moment of sensual pleasure or the greatest moment of aversion, and you come to mindfulness. And the two aspects are of that practice, or what's going on right now, whether it's the aversion or the incredible sensual pleasure, what's going on and what are the instructions that will carry me towards enlightenment? And if you have both of those things together in your mind, then you're not really craving more of the great one, or you're not pushing away the bad one, you're just with it and remembering, okay, it's going to change, it's going to exhibit impermanence, it's an aspect of suffering when it ends, and it's not me. So those three things are going to come out of staying with it and remembering the instructions. And that's the framework of enlightenment.
So seeing clearly the nature of these pleasures, even very wholesome, sweet pleasures. Right? Okay. What's your name?
Martin.
Martin?
Martin.
Yes, Martin. Thank you.
Somewhat related to the ones that you just made, which I think that craving is really largely a function of incompletion with the experience. And that essentially it has to do with not having really done it, having sleepwalked through it, having been distracted in sex and wondering about your performance, or thinking about the next thing you're going to eat or while you're eating it. That constant lack of attention, mindfulness to what the experience is what I think is the root of a lot of craving. And that you get full if you really experience something completely, which we seldom, if ever, do. So that's my senses.
Great. Other people?
I was thinking
thank you,
some
Martin.
Of those extreme ascetic practices. The path of renunciation can be a real trap too. It becomes almost the opposite of pleasure seeking, but rather seeking after what is the I had the right words a few minutes ago and they just went poof. But anyway, renunciation can become an attachment, and I see it as very averse. It can be aversive, like pushing away the life force. Attachment to I forgot what that was. That's okay. But I have a question. In the 5th century BC, when the Buddha was around, were tantric yoga practices around at that time?
I don't know
how far that goes.
Yeah, that goes to what you were saying. I don't know for sure at all. I suspect there were definitely yogic practices. And then probably they got played around with the whole Mahayana view that came in with Tibetan Buddhism especially. And it got intertwined with a very, I think, positive development, which was a re-respect for the feminine. So it's all kind of together. But to go on, yeah, did you want to say more about that?
Okay.
Well, let me offer a couple comments myself. So, to put it a certain kind of way, you know, the brain basically has, we evolved these three motivational systems. Crocodiles and snakes and sharks have two of the three, approaching and avoiding. Mammals, birds, primates, and especially humans have the third system, which is attaching. So we have approaching, avoiding, and attaching. And you can see suffering in each one of those three systems, right? You can see greed and frustration in the approaching system, and you can see approaching or aiming for certain unwholesome goals like compulsions or addictions. In the avoidance system, you can see again suffering of fear and hatred, aversion, and you know, being at war with the world, even a war with oneself. And even in the attaching system, again, you can see a lot of suffering there around things like feeling abandoned or ashamed or lonely. And it's interesting to think about certain pleasures in each one of those systems, and I've been thinking more about this lately, where they don't seem to generate craving. Like, for example, gratitude, feeling grateful, is kind of the fulfillment of the approach system. Feeling, and it's both the fulfillment and the path. For the avoidance system, being peaceful, in other words, not hating, not resisting, being at peace, is sort of the path and the fulfillment of that system. And with the attachment system, the kind of path and the fulfillment of that system is being loving, and loving in a sense of kind of interdependence, interconnectedness, oneness, right? And so isn't it interesting that people don't crave gratitude, peacefulness, or lovingness? They don't crave being loving. There's certain wholesome, and these are very pleasurable experiences, would we not say? Gratitude is very pleasurable in a broad sense of the word. Peacefulness is pleasurable. The Buddha said the highest happiness is peace. And then to be loving, loving is a great pleasure itself. So that's what really interests me, how to play with these systems. Mother Nature endowed us with these intensely craving, clinging systems that are, whose engine is suffering, right?
But I don't know who it was saying, it's the craving comes out of it not being satisfied.
That, so, you, Martin was saying Martin, that, exactly right.
In the incompleteness, yeah. And then...
That's
and,
right.
And in the peace and in the loving and
the gratitude
that is it.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And then the question then becomes how to take it as not just it's the whole Tibetan notion of the path, the fruit is the path. It's a powerful idea. To take the fulfillment as the method. In other words, to come from gratitude, not end up with gratitude, to come from peacefulness, not just end up with peacefulness, to come from lovingness. You know, to paraphrase Stephen Covey, you know, love before you seek to be loved. You know, which we're saying the same thing there. So I want to just offer that as something to play with. And increasingly lately, almost as a practice, I've started practicing with just beginning with being grateful, peaceful, and heartful. Just whatever those words are for you, just start there. And then it's very interesting. It's as if, you know, to use the Tibetan metaphor, that when the mind is really clear, thoughts self-liberate. And the metaphor is like snowflakes landing on a hot stove. They're cooking outside in a hot stove, right? Snowflakes land and they self-liberate as soon as they arise. As soon as they arrive, they self-liberate. You know, when we're in that grateful, thankful, peaceful place, desire just kind of, habits of craving, habits of desire arise, but they almost self-liberate in the arising because they're held in a frame of being grateful, peaceful, and heartful.
Could you say those three words again?
grateful, peaceful, and heartful.
Well, that you said that you were concentrating on.
Those are my three. Yeah, gratitude, peacefulness, and lovingness, or, you know, grateful, peaceful, heartful. Sorry. Yeah.
So, so my dog recently died. I can say this. And what I realize is, as I'm going through my grieving process, is that what is missing, there was, I saw something on the floor, it looked like her for a moment, out of the corner of my eye, and immediately I felt a physiological thing happening in my body. That, so there's the loving, that it's also attached to, I mean, it's connected with a physiological brain. I mean, I felt it. I felt the warmth spread. Mm-hmm. So, where am I going with this? There's a question here, but I'm not quite sure what the question is. It's like, or a comment that gratitude too. There's a physiological part to it.
Yeah.
There's a physiological part to the loving. That's the sex comes. It when it comes out of that, then it's. Whole.
Right. It's the way my languaging of what I think you're getting at is it's fulfilling in the act of, in the moment of arising. You know, the love, the feeling during lovemaking is fulfilling. So there isn't a craving for more. Mm-hmm. Our thirst is satisfied in the, you know, thirst on
crazy. It comes
crazy.
From that place.
Yeah.
But it can come from another place.
Yeah. Where it's pleasant, and then you want more of it, you know. But let me just offer two more points, and then maybe hear from Martin, and then we'll wrap it up. But so that's one reflection I just offer you. You know, how to think of squarely face these very powerful systems, these motivational systems that want to reach for the pleasant, push away the unpleasant, and attach the love object and cling to the love object. Clutch at the love object. How do we deal with those systems that helped our ancient ancestors pass on their genes very, very effectively? And a couple more things. One is, it does strike me that there are many, many pleasures that are actually extremely useful and that guide us. And that a lot of times, the question is, what's the result? For example, when we're with someone, it's like positive feedback. It often helps us get to a place of resolving a problem with that person to feel our way into the pleasure of really understanding them and letting go of a position that's been an obstruction between us. It's our pleasure is guiding us. Or often experiencing the reward of stepping out of a stressful situation that we've just kind of put up with or sort of assumed that we had to keep doing. Right? There's a place for that. I mean, literally at the most basic level, like, my back's a little vulnerable, I'll move in a certain way, I'll move toward the pleasure of that tells me, yeah, that's a better place to have your body. So I think there's a place for that. We're guided by those, and they're a very interesting category. The other thing to offer is, in terms of a way to participate in a world of pleasure without getting caught by it, point one, really do not underestimate the mechanical urgency through which the brain attaches to rewards. Do not underestimate its power. You know, do not. And do not, as part of that, to me, it's appreciate the number of deeply wise people, like the Buddha in that passage, who said, if you're serious about awakening, you know, watch out for sensual pleasure. Right. He also really stressed, watch out for anger and ill will. He actually put more focus on aversion than he did on grasping. As if, in other words, aversion was a greater obstruction, really. Point one. But point two, a way out of that, is as pleasure arises, see its emptiness. See its emptiness. It's like Ajahn Chah described this beautiful cup. He said, I have this beautiful cup, but I see that it's already broken. It's already faded. It's not that I'm averse to it, but I see that it's already gone. You know, when you look at El Capitan, see that it's already exfoliated.
Clear feeling.
Yeah.
Again.
That's right. And that to me is, you know, when you have that fantastic truffle in your mouth, don't swallow. You're on your, when you're on the edge of orgasm for an hour at Moore University and you haven't gone all the way over, you know, that too is empty. Okay, a couple more and we'll wrap up. Oh boy, more. I thought we were asked, so do you want to wait on that, Martin? Or, yeah, Nan, see?
I just wanted to say, is there ever consideration for the positive results of the brain always going to the negative? Like, I'll give you a little example. Like, I do these drawings and I take them and do little critique my stuff all the time, and I'm always looking for the worst thing. Every drawing I look for the worst thing, you know.
The flaw.
And I think that's good, because I keep looking for the worst things, and then I think you gradually, you know, work something better. So there's some positive result of the brain hitting on the negatives.
You're discerning. Well, fine. Fine. Yeah, he does use a lot of metaphors of skilled craftspeople, you know, winnowing away what's not essential. So I think that would be very consistent with what you're saying. And we do that with our own mind. We see the taints and the afflictions within our own mind, just like you're seeing, you know, the smudges and lack of skillfulness in the pictures you're looking at. Okay, Martin?
I was trying to unpack your suggestion about cultivating at the outset of the meditation something peaceful, loving, and grateful. And I was trying to understand, well, what does that feel like? Is it something, is it a feeling? I mean, where does it live? And what does it feel like? And then when you made the comment about your dog dying, it occurred to me that really those feelings really are experienceable when you attach an object to it. And that as themselves, just as concepts, it's hard to experience them. And and then when you attach an object to it, that's when you become attached to things. And so I'm wondering if you can comment on kind of what do these three things feel like to you, and how do you conjure them up? How do you cultivate them?
Yeah. I'm very engaged right now with considering the brain of clinging. So this is a path of practice. The end of this path, so the fulfillment and the path itself are non-clinging, right? So I think, how in the world do you do that with a brain that's designed by nature to cling and crave really well? And so I've been reflecting a lot lately, what is the brain of clinging? And what is the brain of non-clinging? I don't have a great answer yet. I don't have a complete answer. I've been building out my answer. I'm starting to write about this. But it's a great question, isn't it? And I think the brain of clinging in these three motivational systems is a brain of greed, hatred, and insecurity. Greed is the approach system. Hatred is the avoid system. Insecurity is the driver in the, or is not a driver, but is a major part of the approach system. Whereas the brain of non-clinging, and at the center of that, I think of it as a triangle, and at the center of that triangle, the brain of clinging, you know, greed, hatred, broadly defined, and insecurity is ignorance and suffering. It's in the center of the triangle. Whereas in the brain of no clinging, it's the fulfillment and the antithesis of greed is gratitude, where you just feel so fulfilled. The view, think of the view in the mind of clinging with regard to the approach system is scarcity, insufficiency. Whereas the view in the brain of no clinging with regard to the approach system, so I'm thinking about each one of these systems, I'm thinking about in the mode of deficit, if you will, and clinging, what is the view? What is the dominant emotion? what is the primary activity for each one of these three systems. And then in the brain of no clinging, for each of these three systems, what is the view, what is the dominant emotion, and what is the activity? And then what is, hang on, Linda. And then what is the fruit? All right. And so with the brain of no clinging, for me, if you think of it, the dominant emotion of greed is the greed system, the approach system rather, is, like I said, gratitude. For the avoidance system, it's peacefulness. There's no aversion. We're at peace. And the dominant quality of the attached system is lovingness and interconnectedness. And at the center of that, the result of all that is wisdom and contentment rather than ignorance and suffering, I think. So that's just the beginning of something. I'm really thinking about what that is. And but what I notice is that for me, gratitude is this wonderful sense of everything's already okay, and I'm just really grateful. I'm just appreciative, right? And I did one of my Just One Things about gratitude a few issues back, distinct from appreciate. Gratitude is a sense of being given. You know, we've been fully given. And then, what does it feel like to be peaceful? There's no sense of contentiousness. Mm. I love that word, contentiousness. Mm-hmm. Non-contention. We're not contending with the world. Mm-hmm. We're not. It is what it is, and we may strongly, vigorously oppose injustice and, you know, harms and so forth, but we don't do it out of a warlikeness. And then with the attached system, we feel always already attached, you know, in this frame of love. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Linda, you've been eager.
That drawing more on the Tibetan tradition than on the Vipassana tradition, sometimes you actually use an object to evoke the feeling of gratitude, the feeling of peace, the feeling of loving kindness. You get the feeling in your body, whatever that is, you evoke the feeling. You let go of the image, you let go of the object. You can just dwell in that feeling. And that's how we practice calling.
But I'd say for myself, it's not object focused. And in fact, I think object focus is almost an obstruction, because it then becomes object-dependent or dualistic for me, personally. Yeah, yeah.
Doors that they have to walk through.
Like, yeah, it's totally cool. Yeah. But, you know, I think that just to wrap here, we really better finish on this one. You might really, in whatever way you do it, and there are many different ways to do it, living in a life full of incredible temptations, with a brain that's hardwired and driven, you know, to identify rewards and threats and love objects and to kind of organize around them, you know, how to live in a way that, you know, craving and clinging are self-liberated upon the moment of arising.
Mm. Wow. There's the trick, yeah.
Right? So let's sit for a minute and absorb that. And then end. May our practice help free ourselves and others from suffering.